It's taken about 6 months to put the finishing touches on ASU's absorbing of the Thunderbird School of Global Management, but now the transaction is official. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's Here and Now, we'll talk about what the merger means for the W.P. Carey School and graduate business education in the Valley. Plus, the end of the year is a good time to talk with people who are leaving long-held positions in Arizona, exit interviews in a way. I'll catch up with House Minority Leader Chad Campbell, who's departing the state legislature after 8 years. I'll find out about Jim Ballinger's decades as head of the Phoenix Art Museum, and we'll learn what's next for Actors Theater Artistic Director Matthew Weiner and former Arizona Republic Editorial Board member Jennifer Doakes. And we'll also revisit one of the most memorable conversations of 2014, when former Phoenix police officer Jason Schechterly joined us to talk about overcoming the challenges related to severe burns he suffered in a rear-end collision more than a dozen years ago. Here and Now is next on KJZZ. The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Sony Pictures will begin streaming the controversial comedy The Interview online starting this hour. It comes a day ahead of Sony's release of the film at select theaters across the country. Last week, Sony had canceled the release after its computers were hacked and threats were made against theaters planning to show the movie. The U.S. believes North Korea was behind the attack. NPR's Arthi Shahani reports.
Sony says it began talking a week ago to Google, Microsoft, and others about streaming the film. CEO Michael Lynton says in a statement, it has always been Sony's intention to have a national platform for the Seth Rogen and James Franco comedy, which is about trying to assassinate North Korea's dictator. He says he never intended to kill it. He was just searching for partners after large movie chains caved to threats of physical violence. The fiasco caused an uproar about the ability of online hackers and cyber attacks to restrict our First Amendment rights. Now Google Play, YouTube, Xbox, and a dedicated website called seetheinterview.com will stream it for $5.99, and it's available in HD for $14.99. Arthi Shahani, NPR News.
The mayor of a St. Louis suburb is offering his condolences to the family of a man who was shot by a police officer last night. Authorities say the officer shot and killed the African-American 18-year-old after he pointed a gun at him at a gas station. Berkeley Mayor Theodore Hoskins says an investigation is underway.
We reviewed the video, and it appears that there was a gun pointed at the officer before the officer fired. But we got to complete our investigation before we take a position.
The shooting occurred just a few miles from Ferguson, where the fatal police shooting of Michael Brown prompted nationwide protests this summer. Former President George H.W. Bush is under observation at a Houston hospital after experiencing shortness of breath Tuesday night. Jack Williams from Houston Public Media reports.
A Bush spokesman says the 90-year-old former president was taken to Methodist Hospital by ambulance after having trouble catching his breath. Jim McGrath says Bush will be held for observation as a precaution. It was almost 2 years ago that the 41st president spent more than 7 weeks in the same hospital with a bad case of bronchitis. Bush is still active and is often seen with his wife Barbara at Houston sporting events. In June, he celebrated his 90th birthday with a tandem parachute jump near his home in Maine. For NPR News, I'm Jack Williams in Houston.
Wall Street is closing at this hour. The markets have a shortened trading day ahead of the Christmas holiday. They'll reopen on Friday. At last check, the Dow Jones Industrial Average was up 27 points at 18,051. The Nasdaq Composite up 12 points. The S&P 500 up 2. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Athena Health, committed to helping physicians manage industry change so they can focus on patient care. More about cloud-based EHR and practice management services at athenahealth.com.
Good morning from KJZZ News in Phoenix. I'm Bruce Drummond. A natural sandstone arch near the Arizona-Utah border that draws 90,000 visitors a year will be closed temporarily for trail repairs. Heavy rains last year washed out a trail that leads from Lake Powell to Rainbow Bridge National Monument. Temporary fixes have kept the monument open, but officials say the trail needs to be built up and reinforced. Most people visit the monument by boat across Lake Powell. Others hike up to 18 miles from Navajo Mountain. Hikers will be able to access the viewing area, but not the remaining trail leading to Lake Powell, which is scheduled to close from January 5th to February 15th. Some Arizona border towns say shoppers are spending less money this holiday season. And as KJZZ's Kathy Ritchie reports, there are two big reasons why.
Store owners in Nogales and Douglas blame the weak peso and long border crossing lines from Mexico to the U.S. for the lull. Both cities rely on Mexican shoppers for sales tax revenue. In Douglas, 65% of the city's revenue comes from that money. Meantime, store owners in Nogales say customers have complained about waiting in line for hours to cross the border by foot. A spokesman for U.S. Customs and Border Protection says the agency works hard to keep wait times low. Kathy Ritchie, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
KJZZ is supported by Friends of Animal Care and Control, funding spay-neuter here in the Valley to end euthanasia of adoptable pets. You can make a real difference by making a year-end tax-deductible donation at SaveShelterPets.org.
Valley forecast calling for sunny skies and 63 degrees. It'll be partly cloudy overnight with a low in the mid-40s. Right now, under mostly sunny skies, it's 59 degrees in Phoenix at 11:06.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Good morning. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. Coming up this hour, a lot of Arizonans are leaving prominent positions as we close 2014. Many of them aren't making changes by choice. Governor Jan Brewer's term limited. Superintendent of Public Instruction John Hoopental lost his reelection bid in the August primary. On today's program, we'll have new interviews with State House Minority Leader Chad Campbell, Phoenix Art Museum Director Jim Ballinger, former Arizona Republic Editorial Board Member Jennifer Doakes, and Actors Theater Artistic Director Matthew Weiner. We'll find out what they'll miss about their jobs and, in some cases, what's next. We'll also present one of our favorite interviews from 2014, former Phoenix Police Officer Jason Schechterle. We start today's program by looking at what the W.P. Carey School of Business at ASU and graduate business education in the Valley will be like now that ASU has taken over the Thunderbird School of Global Management. Joining me for a few minutes is John Byrne, editor-in-chief of poetsandquants.com, a site that focuses on providing information and analysis of the best business schools in the U.S. John, thanks for squeezing us in.
My pleasure.
What are the biggest changes you're looking for that this merger is going to bring about?
Well, I think the most significant thing that it does is it essentially makes what is a regional brand, the Carey School, international. You know, Thunderbird has had a great reputation for global business education. It was a pioneer in that field. And as a consequence of that, its alumni is spread all over the world. So it kind of touches many different countries and far-flung areas that Arizona State does not. So on one level, it allows Arizona State, totally as a business proposition, to significantly expand its reach. And the way they're going to use Thunderbird is, I think, is actually quite clever. They're going to primarily use it as an executive education play. That would be for, you know, short courses for executives and managers around the world, and for specialized degree programs, like one-year programs that might result in a master's in global management, and not your traditional MBA program. So they won't be cannibalizing what they currently have at the Carey School.
Do you foresee any bumps along the way when mergers take place? There always seem to be some.
Yeah, and, you know, Thunderbird has been through, to put it honestly, hell, in the last 18 months or 2 years. The school has, you know, really hit a lot of rocks. It's losing a good amount of money. There's tremendous controversy with a certain alumni group who were unhappy with an earlier deal with a for-profit education provider. The alumni seem to be pleased with this merger because Arizona State's a terrific university and has the kind of credibility in academia that the for-profit provider didn't have. Nonetheless, you know, the school is still losing money, and to get it in the black and to get it to thrive is going to mean a lot of change, cutbacks, and probably, you know, it's going to be tough for a lot of people who are invested in the old Thunderbird, which really will no longer exist.
Yeah. John, what is all the drama meant for, I guess there isn't really a legacy anymore, as you mentioned, with Thunderbird, but what did all the drama mean for Thunderbird's reputation, and can this merger with Arizona State make people's memories shorter as far as that goes?
Yeah, you know, I think we're wonderful creatures because we tend to repress the negative over time.
Okay.
And I think that over time, people will forget all the controversy, which, you know, brought out a lot of fairly negative feelings. So it certainly diminished the reputation of Thunderbird. It made Thunderbird an asset that was less valuable, I believe. And it also exposed how weak it was. And I think the primary reason the school weakened its position is a result of how other business schools around it have changed. You know, when they first started, they were the only game in town. And when I say town, I mean the universe. They were the only player offering a truly global MBA program. And most other schools paid lip service to it, if they even paid any attention at all. And then what's happened in the last 20 years is no school can afford to avoid globalization. And in fact, in many cases, it's been thrust upon them. They've had to recruit international students, partly because there weren't enough domestic students to go around. So that happened automatically. Then they had to recruit international faculty because there weren't enough domestic faculty to go around. And then by nature of that and the forces of globalization, they increased the amount of global content in all their courses. They started putting on immersive international trips for their MBAs, mm-hmm. giving them experiential projects abroad. So what's happened is the other schools have caught up or have closed the gap in such a way as to make Thunderbird less distinctive. And that really resulted in the problems the school had and led to the merger.
John Byrne John, I need to cut you off. I'm sorry. That's all the time we've got. But John Byrne is editor-in-chief, poetsandquants.com, and thanks for squeezing us in amongst your Christmas shopping. Have a great day.
Happy holidays.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. On today's program, we'll be featuring interviews with Arizonans who are moving on from long-held positions. First up is State House Minority Leader Chad Campbell. We spoke earlier. What is it like being a Democrat in leadership with a Democratic governor, then a Republican governor?
Two different worlds, obviously. You have a Democratic governor. You obviously have kind of a backstop when you're the minority to help you negotiate with the majority in the legislature. And Napolitano had no problem being that backstop. She wielded the veto pen when necessary and I think did a very good job of it. You know, versus, again, going to Republican governor, Republican-led legislature, then you're in the minority at that point. I mean, fully in the minority. Your leverage is very, very diminished, and your ability to proactively get things done is really diminished. I think the other big thing for me, though, too, was my first 2 years down there when we did have Napolitano as governor, I wasn't in leadership. I was more rank and file, so I really can't speak to some of the behind-the-scenes things as much as I could over the past 6 years.
Yeah.
You know, I worked with the governor very closely when she was here, but I wasn't in leadership. As opposed to the last 6 years with Governor Brewer in place, I've been in leadership throughout those 6 years. And so very different situation, because then you're dealing with the Republican leadership and the governor's office. But again, you don't have that leverage you would have had with the Democratic governor.
You're not a wallflower by any means. But I've
never been accused of that, no.
But when you're in a position where your ideas, in some cases, I would say many cases, if they were good ideas, doesn't really seem to matter, because it really matters what the numbers are. So did you have certain weeks, certain months where you were just like, I know I've got to lead this group, but man, this is frustrating?
Yeah, and I mean, a great case in point about having an idea that you think would be well-received and it just gets nowhere because it's a Democratic idea. I still remember the debate we had, what was that, I guess now 4 years ago or so, around the 3 years ago maybe, around the corporate tax cut package, the one that's still being phased in, and the one that Speaker Adams put together along with Governor Brewer. And I put together a separate corporate tax cut package that was, I think, much more structurally sound, didn't have the long-term damaging impacts that one is going to have on the state and is having right now, and still would have made us competitive to attract more business. And I remember I woke up one day and there was a column in the Republic from Bob Robb a very conservative columnist, and he was comparing that plan, their plan, compared to my plan, and he actually said, Campbell's plan is much better for the state. It'll make us competitive, and it's not going to bankrupt us or hurt us economically in the future. And, of course, my plan never got a hearing. So that kind of summed up, I think, that experience. And we joke down there a lot of times, the best way to get a bill passed as a Democrat is to find a Republican to sponsor it. And that's what we do sometimes. And that's the nature of the beast. I'm sure if you're in another state where it's Democratic-controlled, you'd be saying this if you're a Republican. It's just the way I think partisan politics works. But it can be frustrating. And I think the biggest thing we as a caucus, at least in the House, over the past 6 years since I've been in leadership, the biggest thing we talked about and kind of viewed ourselves as was the watchdogs and kind of holding the majority accountable and going to the public when we were unhappy. And a great example of this recently was Senate Bill 1062. And they passed it, but then we made it a public fight and really forced the hand, I think, of the governor to veto it. And we worked on a very broad coalition to make that happen.
What happens when you witness Republicans, so-called moderates, getting hammered by their own caucus for doing that? Do you shake your head, or do you think, okay, it's nice to see someone from the other party getting kicked a little bit, or are you thinking, boy, can't we just get along?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's more of a can't we all just get along type of mentality. But I don't think that's just Arizona specific. I think if you look at D.C., same thing. And it's not just this isn't just a Republican fighting amongst themselves. This happens to the Democratic side of things, too, when you're in the majority. We just don't have that here in Arizona. It's a partisan issue. And I think, you know, to get philosophical for a little minute or for a quick minute, I think that, again, D.C., if you look at D.C., it's very symptomatic of what is wrong, I think, with politics and the two-party system. And somehow we've got to break that gridlock. But it's very tough for people to break from their party kind of line these days and not get attacked by their base. And that's true for both sides. I think the Republicans have it worse than we do right now because of the Tea Party phenomenon and such. But it's true for both sides. And that has to somehow be kind of, you know, unraveled or solved, because that's what's, I think, creating the gridlock in D.C. at least.
Why'd you run for the legislature in the first place? I mean, were you an idealist?
No, I don't think I'm an idealist. And yeah. I don't think most people would work with me and said I'm pretty pragmatic. And I compromise when I think we have a good compromise. And when I don't, I stand up for what I believe in. But no, I mean, I'm a local. I'm a Phoenix native, been here my whole life. Love Arizona. And, you know, a seat opened up in my district. I had some people call me from the legislature that were sitting members and wanted me to run, and some community leaders. And so I jumped in. I never had any plan of being the Democratic leader or anything like that. Just really trying to serve the community. And, it was a great 8 years and really wouldn't trade it in for anything.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with outgoing Minority Leader of the House in Arizona, Chad Campbell. He served in the legislature for 8 years. Biggest pleasant surprise, biggest accomplishment, biggest disappointment?
Biggest pleasant surprise was the day Governor Brewer came out for Medicaid expansion, obviously. And probably biggest accomplishment was Medicaid expansion, I think. I don't think people understand still, or I shouldn't say, I don't think a lot of people understand the magnitude of Medicaid on the future of this state. And if you look at it right now, actually, case in point, our economy is still suffering here. We're not recovering like the rest of the country. And the one sector that is growing in the state is healthcare. And that's in large part due to the Medicaid expansion. And so I give Governor Brewer credit for that. And it was one of the few instances where we worked together and crossed the aisle, I think, and worked in a bipartisan way. You know, on the flip side of that, though, biggest disappointment, the fact that Governor Brewer didn't take this opportunity and use her succession to structurally fix what's wrong with Arizona. She passed or promoted a temporary sales tax and promoted that to the voters, and that was a horrible idea. And we're seeing the problems with it now, which is what I predicted 4 years ago, which is why I voted against it. We knew that wasn't going to solve the state's problems. She handed out a large corporate tax cut package that was balanced by passing the vote or making the voters pass the sales tax on themselves. And so, 6 years of Governor Brewer, and we're literally right back to where we started from when she took over office. And that's the biggest disappointment, because we didn't need to be there. I think we would have had a group of Democrats and Republicans who would have worked with her on significant tax reforms. We could have fixed things. And I think we could have put Arizona in a very competitive place. But we're really back to square one, and I'm not sure where we go from here now.
So you served 8 years in the legislature. You know, there was talk, I don't know if it was by you or just people who like you, who thought that you should to challenge Fred DeVal in the Democratic primary for governor. So can you stay out of politics? Would you prefer to, or will you feel the itch at some point?
I'm sure I'll be back at some point. I mean, I didn't run, and this is not a secret anymore. I mean, I'd run for because of family issues and family health issues and some other things, so I couldn't run for statewide office. I'm sure I'll be back at some point. It is kind of nice to be back in the private sector fully, though. I'm not going to lie. But I will be working on things with the Democratic Party. We'll be working on things with, I think, some statewide initiatives. And I really would like to try to address the bigger problem of voter engagement in this state, putting aside the partisanship about it, just voter engagement in general, and trying to figure out how we can elect people that I think are a little more responsive and more in touch, as you were saying earlier, with the average person in the state. And that's something that I'm committed to over the next couple of years. And then we'll see how that all falls and how that all shakes out, and maybe I'll come back at some point for some office. We'll see.
Outgoing House Minority Leader Chad Campbell talking about his years in the legislature. Chad, thanks.
Thank you.
Still to come on Here and Now, we'll continue our exit interviews with former Arizona Republic editorial board member Jennifer Doakes, San Phoenix Art Museum outgoing director Jim Ballinger. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Organic Living, your organic home goods store, carrying over 15 organic mattresses. See the entire line of products at their showroom or online at organiclivingaz.com.
You're listening to KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're featuring exit interviews today with Arizonans leaving long-held prominent positions. Jennifer Doakes worked for the Phoenix Gazette and the Arizona Republic for the past 30 years. But with dramatic changes going on at the newspaper, Doakes chose to leave earlier this month. Before joining the editorial board, she had been a reporter and copy editor.
I started at the Phoenix Gazette in 1985, a couple of years out of college. I had a reporting job and a copy editing job. And then from the copy desk, I was promoted to the editorial board of the Arizona Republic, which was a shocker to a lot of people because at that time, I was the youngest member, the only woman, and the only minority on the board. So it was quite a change for the board at the time. And it's just been this job, being on the editorial board, has been one of the best journalism jobs I think anybody could ever have.
What did you look most forward to on a daily basis in your job?
Just seeing what would end up in my inbox. I mean, every day there were offerings from people of guest columns and that, you know, people have very interesting things to say. And it was always fun to know what people were thinking. I mean, when you craft an opinions piece, you've put some thought into it. And it's nice to be able to digest what people's innermost thoughts are. And then also reading letters to the editor. We get 400 letters to the editor a week, and it was always fun to see what people were writing about in terms of letters to the editors. You could always get a good sense of how things were going to go in the election. It's just a good pulse of the community, the letters to the editor.
There were some people, and are some people in all positions, that talk about how connected to the community they are. Now, you really, in a lot of ways, I mean, I think of you, and I'm not sure how long you had this position, but it's sort of the my turn person, yeah, and the person that was sort of the last wall when it came to getting a column, as you mentioned, a guest column in the paper. So how did you feel that affected how you connected with the broader community?
Oh, it was wonderful. It was, I felt deeply connected to the community. It was a delight to be able to read those columns and to work with people to get it right in terms of the written word and its presentation into the newspaper. It was just a wonderful view of Arizona to be able to work with the community that way.
Did it make you feel better, worse about the community?
Depends on the subject. It depends on the subject. There, I would say in the last, since Obama was elected, there have been some, it's turned harsh in a lot of ways in terms of national politics. The rhetoric is a lot tougher than I thought it would be at this point. I thought people maybe would have calmed down by now, but it hasn't happened. And in some respects, it's gotten worse. So that's been a little disappointing and a little unpleasant. But other than that, it's been fun. It's a great job to have. It's really fun.
You mentioned being a woman, being African-American, and being involved in a major position at this newspaper. Yeah. And how did that affect you, or did it in any way? Did you feel in any way like you were had to be sort of a standard bearer in a sense?
A little bit, but I think I was so young at the time that I was clueless, really, as to how big a deal that was. And it wasn't until over the years I've run into people who said how important it was to see my face and to read my words in the paper. It was an opinion that they felt that they can connect to. And that was nice. I didn't quite fully appreciate what a big deal that was until years later.
How important do you think diversity is when we accept and think about what other people's points of view are?
The fun of the job is to listen to other people's points of view and to respect them and to appreciate where they're coming from. I think one of the biggest joys that I've had in the job that I most recently held is opening up the pages to other points of view. And when I started on the editorial board, the opinions page space was reserved for people with titles and people who were somebody as defined by the leaders of the editorial board at the time. And I've always felt it was important to get regular folks in there because their ideas are just as important and they do have very good ideas. And so it was nice to be able to open the pages up, not necessarily just to people who are, quote, somebody, but to people who are somebody in their own right and have an opinion and it's and a view worth sharing with the broader audience.
For many decades across the country, sort of the newspaper was that public gathering place, that, that community that everyone held on to. If it's not going to be newspapers, and who knows if it will be or not, how important is it, do you think, that there is still that place where people of different opinions can read together, argue together, whatnot?
It has to be. It has to be part of this, of our society. I don't want to be in a society where we don't have that. And we have to be engaged with each other somehow. And I think the format that the newspaper has with, you know, these are people who aren't blogging anonymously. They aren't trolls, you know, online. These are people who sign their names to tell you where they live and want to be part of a greater conversation. And we need those people, and we need those people to continue to express themselves somewhere, somehow.
The 30 years you've been in this business, what changes have you seen in Phoenix that you have liked and others that you thought, well, okay, we've grown. Maybe growing that way wasn't so great.
I like that you still can come to Phoenix immediately and have an impact. I like that newcomers can become somebody soon and quickly if they invest the time and energy to become part of the community. On the other hand, I don't like that the newcomers don't necessarily respect the traditions of Phoenix and don't necessarily appreciate the history and how we got to be here and why. And I just wish the old and the new would somehow combine and create this new Phoenix that I think it's coming. It's coming, but I just wish that we were a little farther along in the process than we are right now.
You're at an exciting point in your life where you're undergoing a big change.
Yeah.
What do you think you'll miss most about what has been an everyday part of your life for 30 years, working in some form or fashion on a newspaper? And the last position you had was a very high position.
Uh-huh.
And what are you most looking forward to having that freedom to try something different?
I already miss my colleagues at the Republic. They're like family. And a lot of us have grown up together. And so I will miss seeing them on a daily basis. I will miss that exposure I got to the different opinions that were coming into the newspaper every day. And but I will take a lot of that with me in my new venture. I will take the perspectives that I've gathered over the 30 years and launch it forward. And hopefully I'll continue to be me. I'll continue to do editing and writing. But in a different way.
Jennifer Doak, she's been a prominent news person here in the Valley for 3 decades. Jennifer, thanks for the time.
Thank you.
It's KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're focusing on exit interviews today with Arizonans who are leaving positions they've held for a long time. Matthew Weiner has been producing artistic director of Phoenix's Actors Theater for nearly 20 years. But the company's going out of business early next year. Weiner says the years since 2008 have been rough.
The scope and scale of our productions has had to react to the, you know, constrictions of the economy significantly. So all of a sudden we started looking at plays that had fewer characters in them, that had fewer production constraints, such as, you know, fewer costumes, fewer sets, not such fancy contraptions on stage, perhaps, things that were less cost intensive, and that has definitely impacted the kinds of plays that we were able to do.
How has that changed your attitude about what you do? Because anyone in any job would say, what I'm doing is rewarding, I'm good at it, and then you run up against more obstacles.
Theater is kind of like one of those things that it's kind of like there's always obstacles. You know, there's never an abundance of resources. And so it's always a question of making the best choice that you can, given the situation that you're in. And I suspect that's, and I know that's true of all businesses. So it's never like, oh, I get to do whatever I want. That's never the case. One of the things that has always been a guiding principle for Actors Theatre and one of our highest values has been the economic dignity of the artists and arts workers who put the work on stage. We have always felt that the artists should not be the primary underwriters of the art form. Artists making a living, professional artists making a living, was one of the founding principles of the company and has continued to be. In terms of how our resources were spent, it always became about people. So as time went on recently, you know, the amount of resources that were available for things other than people became tighter and tighter.
So being producing artistic director for nearly two decades, would you describe what it was like to be the artistic director? And I mean, we've talked about the challenges, but how different were you then in terms of how gung-ho you were? What sort of shows interested you? Not just what interested the audience, but interested you. Has that changed over the two decades?
That's a good question. I think I've always been interested in theater as a form of, as a place to discuss social issues. And I've always been interested in theater as a place where we can come together to figure things out as a community. But I also think that as, you know, over the past 20 years, I've had children, and that has changed how I view the world. I think that, you know, when I started, I was, you know, 35 years old. Now I'm 54 years old. And I think that even at 35, I still had maybe a little bit of an angry young man kind of thing going, or you know, or maybe a little bit more anti-authority thing going. And now I think I understand the world to be far more complex than I used to. I think that I now seek plays where understanding and a sense of coming together is more important. I think also I've learned I've learned a lot more about what audiences like and what audiences respond to. And I think that one of the joys and pleasures of 20 years working in the same community and working with many of the same artists is developing a way of working with these artists. I mean, some of these artists I have worked with for 20 years, and we have you know, a long history together now. And, you know, we've been to each other's weddings, and, you know, we've watched each other's children grow up. And I think that that sense of history that we have with each other shows up in the work that we bring to the stage, and that there is a kind of powerfulness and an intimacy to it that actually is quite amazing, and that the audiences and our community has been treated to some very special performances over the past, you know, decade or so.
Mm-hmm. It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Matthew Weiner, the producing artistic director for Actors Theater of Phoenix for the past nearly 20 years. The company will cease operations over the next 30 to 60 days. Matthew, what's it like, I mean, even with all the other concerns, but what's it been like over the past 20 years or so, to be an artist and to work with artists on a regular basis?
I think I've been one of the luckiest people around. I love it. I get to go to work every day and do what I love, have done what I love. I get to tell stories with wonderful people. And we get to create situations. I mean, as a producer, I mean, one of the things that I, the way that I looked at my job was that I created situations where others could be successful. And that the goal was to tell a story in a dark room to a lot of people. And, you know, live theater is kind of a wonderful thing. It's kind of, you can look at it two ways. One is that it creates a private experience in a public arena, because the experience of watching a show is private, because, you know, it's in your head. You know, you bring to it whatever you bring to it, and your experiences definitely influence how you perceive a show. And then the other way is that it is a public experience. I've worked with some amazingly talented artists here. I mean, one of the things that Actors Theatre does is work with local artists, you know, artists based in the Valley. And I've been able to develop some long and powerful relationships with the artists here. It's been an adventure. It's been very full. I've never been bored. Let's put it that way.
Well, that's nice. Yeah.
Never been bored.
Do you know what you want to do next? And what about the broader theater scene in this area?
I've always been inherently optimistic, and I'm working hard to hold on to that. I don't think theater's going to go away. You know, we've been telling stories to each other since we sat around campfires, you know, for a long time. I think that I don't know what the future holds for Phoenix. There's some wonderful theater companies here in the Valley. I think that some of them are going to be very successful, and I wouldn't be surprised if others, you know, are not able to be successful. But there are some that are doing wonderful work. Actually, many of them are doing wonderful work. That may or may not be the thing that determines their success. I think that I hope that the community understands that as the economy recovers, that arts and culture need more investment and more attention paid, that it is what makes our community vital and exciting to live in. In terms of myself, I really don't know. I've had the same job for 20 years, which is pretty unusual in today's day and age. So I'm going to take some time and try to figure out what the future holds. But I am hopeful for the future of arts and culture in this community. We have some amazing leaders. We have some amazing arts and culture organizations. And I think that overall, the people of Phoenix, Metro, you know, Maricopa County and Metro Phoenix are very lucky to have some of these organizations here. I just wish there were more of them. Mm.
Matthew Weiner, Producing Artistic Director for Actors Theatre of Phoenix. He's been in that position for nearly 20 years. The company will be closing its doors over the next 30 to 60 days. Matthew, good luck, and thanks for sharing all this with us.
Well, thank you.
I'm Steve Goldstein. It's KJZZ's Here and Now. Our final exit interview is with Jim Ballinger, who is retiring from his longtime director position at the Phoenix Art Museum. Ballinger first came to Phoenix in 1974.
First time I landed, literally, in Phoenix, there was Terminal 1. You got off the airplane outdoors, and the fellow who hired me met me at baggage claim outdoors. We've changed. I joined a museum, and basically a cultural community. You can do this across, Stevie, as you well know. We had 17 staff members then. We had a budget of $367,000. Today, the museum has a budget of $10,367,000, and we have about 150 employees. So we've met with a lot of success over the years, a lot of dedicated staff members, a lot of dedicated trustees, donors, collectors who have given us works of art. City of Phoenix been a great partner. All that said, it sounds like everything I should say is just rosy. Well, no, the answer is we have our challenges. We experience, as so much Phoenix has, just an upward tick of growth year after year after year, and the last few years of either decline or, in our case, I think, proudly staying even when you look at what's going on culturally and keeping our funding where it was in order to continue. But if we're going to grow and move us forward, move theater, opera, symphony forward, we all face the challenge of, I'll say, scarcity of resources to a certain degree of how we get that support.
Jim, how have changing expectations changed how you do things, if they have? Because, again, decades ago, people liked the Phoenix Art Museum, but it was obviously a much different kind of place. It was not an internationally renowned place as it is now. So now that people know it is that, how are the challenges different?
Well, they're different. I mean, good example, we opened at the end of January an exhibition of Leonardo da Vinci's Codex Lester. I can guarantee you 30, 40 years ago, that would not have come to the Phoenix Art Museum. We're doing that with the Minneapolis Institute of Art, the North Carolina Museum of Art. We're partnering that the following year with an exhibition of Michelangelo drawings coming from the Casa Buonarroti in Florence, Italy. Again, we would never have been able to do those things.
What are a couple of things about the job that you have loved? And maybe there's a thing or two that, you know, maybe didn't start out so great, maybe got better, maybe didn't.
Yeah. Well, the things you love, I would guess, in any field are the core values of why you got in the field to start with. So what I was an art historian. I wanted to be a curator. I wanted to do great exhibitions. I wanted to share the joy of art and the celebration of art and artists with the people of our community. I think we've done that over the years. It takes all kinds of avenues, some of its exhibitions, some of its programs, some of maybe film situations. I think that's always the joy. And if you say what's going to be missed, you know, I love art. I'm going to love art till the day I die. The other joy has been, I think, to build the museum. And now that's a big abstract, but the things that I really hold amazing as we look back are the 88 bond election, when we actually raised taxes in this community to build cultural facilities. And now it's the Science Center, theaters, the Phoenix Art Museum, Black Theater Troupe. It has made a difference. And what does that investment do? It pays off in just multiples over with support that comes in and hold people here, help education, do a lot of things. The frustrations usually come around, you can see where you want to go and you can't get there fast enough. That's scheduling sometimes. Sometimes it's getting other people to agree to make contributions and invest in the museum. We're at a time, Steve, of real interesting crossroads, I think, culturally. And we, I mean, in the country, I'm guessing you face the same issues. Audience change, museums traditionally, older audience. How do we inherit and bring younger people in? What does that take? What are the likes? What are the dislikes? Nobody's got the secret yet. Technology is probably both our friend and our foe for a while, like most businesses. Yes, we can get our word out faster, but are we getting it to the right place? Are the right people hearing it? How do we do market studies to come back and do that? We're still learning our way.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Jim Ballinger. He's the director of the Phoenix Art Museum. And he's leaving the position after more than three decades in that specific position, more than four decades with the museum itself. Did you ever seriously consider moving on? And has this been a tough community to make the inroads that have been made?
Yes, of course. I had many inquiries and actually direct offers actually over the years to move to bigger things. The one thing that I would say really held me here, I can only speak for myself, is I always felt that because it was the era in which I started, the people I knew, I was able to know the people who were making a difference in the community as it grew, and we all kind of matured together. The other thing was that you get to a certain plateau, and then you think, I need more challenge. Well, Phoenix was in such a growth mode that I feel like I've worked at three different museums, maybe four, just they happen to be at the same location. When you think of changing the just the physical plants 400% the size it was when we started, kind of shows we can do. So the things I would have reached out to do are like that. I will say in recent years there's been a frustration. The frustration is, it has to do with the recession, is that we've kind of been treading water, if you will, and we knew we'd have to do that. I think my biggest frustration is coupled with that is a spirit in the community that we don't put education first anymore. I know there's a lot of dialogue and everybody says they do, but I think we have to stand back and realize we really don't. We've made decisions that have been negative financially to school district after school district after school district in the state. And that affects the Phoenix Art Museum on a daily basis. We no longer have the school tours that come to the museum that used to. We do reach out. Almost every school tour that comes, we pay to have them come. We raise the money. We're happy to do it. It's the absolute right thing to do. But at the end of the day, if we want to have quality citizens, and I mean that in almost the 18th century sense, we need to have the best public education there is. We tend to argue about whether we're ranked 48th or 42nd. To me, the only discussion is when will we be in the top half? Because until we're in the top half, the arts are not going to flourish. Companies are not going to flourish. That is the basis of everything. And we've got to recognize that. And a large group of people need to come together. And I'm not even sure where it's easy to say it's the legislature. Maybe it's not. Maybe it's voters, wherever it is. That's got to be fixed.
Phoenix Art Museum Director Jim Ballinger, who's retiring from the position after 33 years. Still to come on Here and Now, we'll revisit one of our favorite interviews from early in 2014 with former Phoenix police officer Jason Schechterly. Stay tuned.
KJZZ is supported by Dayspring United Methodist, a progressive and inclusive church in Tempe. With Christmas Eve services at 6, 8, and 11 p.m. and weekly jazz services starting in January. More info at dayspringumc.org.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks for joining us. It should be a partly cloudy Christmas Eve in the Valley tonight, a low near 45 degrees, and then for Christmas Day, partly cloudy to partly sunny skies with a high tomorrow near 61. Sunny skies on Friday with the high dropping down to 56 degrees. Stay with us at noon for NPR's Here and Now from Boston. Skies are mostly sunny around the Valley right now. The relative humidity is 17%, and it's 59 degrees at KJZZ at 11:48.
This is KJZZ's Here and Now. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. We close today's program by revisiting part of one of our favorite interviews of 2014. 13 years ago, Phoenix police officer Jason Schechterly's Ford Crown Victoria patrol car was rear-ended by a taxi and burst into flames. He was trapped in the car for 8 minutes and left with severe burns, and after more than 50 surgeries, he's still recovering. Schechterly and his co-author Landon J. Napoleon recount the story in the book Burning Shield. They joined me in studio. I started by asking Schechterly how he was feeling, physically and mentally.
Physically, I'm feeling great, as healthy as can be. I haven't experienced pain in a great number of years, very, very healthy. And mentally, couldn't be better. I love every part of my life. I look forward to every day, and I'm a better person for everything that I've gone through.
How long did it take to get to that point? We're talking 13 years after the accident. So even as an optimistic guy, how long did it take you to get to that point?
I'd say the toughest part was the first year, the first 12 months. And it's interesting that today is the anniversary. And 13 years, I don't think much of it. It's just kind of another day. But that first anniversary was the interesting little box that I had to get out of. When I woke up March 27th of 2002, made great strides after that. So that was the mental part. Going back to work, having another child, there's been a lot of big moments in my life and my journey that have kept me moving forward.
Are those the biggest moments? Talking about getting back to work, having another child, having your family support you like that?
Yeah, it's been incredible. I mean, the family support, the friend support. I was very blessed that I had a job that was covered in the media and gave the public a chance. You know, we live in a great community. I really can't imagine, had this happened anywhere else in the country, the Valley here, it's kind of like being in a small town, and the support and love that I felt has been tremendous. So all those things, and then, yeah, going back to work, I mean, I loved my job, and I wanted to get back. It took me 18 months, but I did get back, and that helped a lot in my recovery.
You've obviously changed physically.
Yes.
How much have you changed mentally and emotionally? Are you a stronger person, a better person?
I think I'm a stronger person emotionally. I enjoy humor a lot more. I like to not take things too seriously. And the strength comes more from understanding and appreciating adversity. This, you know, my overall story, when you really look at it, when you really read this book, the fact that I was a police officer and the fact that I was burned and disfigured, those are the two least important parts of this. We all face adversity, and it's been 13 years. That's old news for me.
Okay.
Now I'm going through what everybody goes through on a daily basis, and so I'm hopeful when people read the book, they will understand how they can get through their own.
You are the epitome of the example of the phrase, putting things in perspective, because people get up, oh, my back hurts, oh, my stomach hurts, and then here you are, all these years later, you know, because a lot of people might have just curled up into a ball. So what were some of the things that kept you strong going through all this?
Family, being a father is, there's nothing like it, and you don't want to take that for granted or be willing to give that up. I was very lucky. Never once did I wish that I didn't survive that accident. It would have been a lot easier to not have survived versus what I was facing, but I was always very thankful and very blessed. You know, the work that the firefighters did that night, the doctors, you got to give them all the credit in the world. I'm not where I'm at today because of me. Every piece of the puzzle was in place for me to be supported and to be able to survive this.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix, talking with Jason Schechterle and Landon J. Napoleon. The new book is called Burning Shield. Landon, how did you guys get together on this? And how much research went into what happened, but also how do you gain Jason's trust? How long did that take? I mean, a subject sometimes is eager to tell the story, sometimes they're not.
Jason and I have a mutual friend, Pat McGroder, a local plaintiff's attorney. And Pat actually represented Jason in his case against Ford. And I've known Pat for probably a decade now. And I knew of Jason, I knew of his story. But surprisingly, over these last 9 years, I'd never met him. And for whatever reason, it finally came together about 15 months ago. Pat said, hey, Jason wants to do this book. And I said, great, let's set up a meeting. So the three of us met. And for me, probably after 45 seconds or so, something clicked. And I said, I absolutely have to write this story. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what that was or why that was. And, you know, as far as getting comfortable, I think Jason had kind of a similar kind of immediate response that, oh, yeah, I think this is going to work. And so we just dived in, and most of my initial, well, all of my initial interviews were with Jason. Spent many, many, many hours primarily at his house. He makes a good cup of coffee. And we just went through the whole thing, and then he put me in touch with his police contacts, doctors, legal.
Now, Jason's being humble. What's the most amazing thing that you've discovered about spending all this time with him and about reliving the story of what happened, not just 13 years ago, but what happened with all the surgeries and all the stuff that he had to go through? What amazes you most about what he's been through?
He mentioned his sense of humor, and I think sometimes people are hesitant when they're around Jason. They're not quite sure what they can or can't say, and they're very respectful and treat things delicately. But I think sense of humor really stands out. And just one thing to share, and this is in the book, but he would joke with family and friends and say, hey, maybe I could get a job for a cigarette company. I could do an ad about the dangers of smoking in bed. And to be able to make light of what he's gone through, I think really speaks to who he is and what's helped him get through this.
Jason, I don't want to belabor this, but we talked about your spirit inside, your sense of humor, but also in the book, there's mention of the fact that, you know, you do the motivational speaking, but you don't talk to young kids, you don't take the family to Disneyland. I mean, you're strong, but is that hurtful in any way, this idea that people looking at the outside as opposed to how you've grown on the inside?
It's not so much hurtful. I try to respect other people's feelings. This is, my appearance is not something you see every day, and I do believe that it can be disruptive, especially to children. That coupled with, I put myself out there, and I love to do the motivational speaking, and I travel. I'm in strange airports all the time, but I still live in a somewhat protective bubble. I only go grocery shopping at the same store every time. I go to the same places for lunch or dinner when I go out. So it's my own, you know, I know what brings me anxiety and stress, and I'm in touch with that, and I'm okay with that. It's part of my permanent adversity is my appearance. I'm always going to deal with that. So I protect myself in the ways that I need to, but especially with kids, you just have to respect that they've got young minds and they're resilient. They get over it, especially when you can talk to them. But I usually don't talk to kids in a formal group setting under seventh grade.
You wanted to be a police officer. I mean, you really wanted to be a police officer and went through a lot of effort to get it.
Yes.
Were you hit hard by the irony when you couldn't do it for a while because of this freak accident, and then you worked so hard to get back to it? Did you feel gypped at first?
I never felt gypped. I was sad. I was disappointed. And even through today, when I see some of my closest friends or guys that I went to the academy with, and I see where they're at in their career, it's sometimes fun to daydream, but it's hard to explain, but I really would not change anything about where I'm at. I believe there's some very good reasons of why the events of March 26, 2001 took place.
Yeah.
And I'm completely okay with those reasons. And, you know, if it wasn't for this, I don't think my youngest son would have the life he has. And I'm going to coach his baseball game today. And to make those memories, to see his little face and think, yeah, it's all completely worth it. Perspective is an easy thing when you're dealing with emotions of fatherhood or things like that. So, no, I don't feel gypped.
And the concept of destiny is really ever-present in this book. Is that a theme you guys both hit on together?
Yes. Landon, this has been a very sensitive, intimate journey for me to get this story out there. In some ways, you know, I want to pay it forward. I want other people to benefit with overcoming their adversity. But if this book never sells a copy, it's a legacy for my kids, and I'm incredibly proud. I've laughed, I've cried, I've relived things that I had forgotten.
Landon, did you laugh and cry when you were writing it?
I still laugh and cry. Even sitting here listening to him, and when you asked him the question, did you feel gypped, I keep thinking, wait, you had to feel gypped, and you had to feel self-pity. And he's got some amazing gene that I think not a lot of people have.
Has it changed your perspective on life?
Yeah, it has. And when you talked about you wake up and, oh, my back hurts and my internet's not buffering fast enough, and you say, wait a minute, those things don't matter. Absolutely.
It's Here and Now on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein in Phoenix. A few more minutes left with Jason Schechterly and Landon J. Napoleon. Their new book is Burning Shield. Jason, let's talk a little bit more about your family, if you don't mind.
Okay.
When you get married to someone, you have certain expectations. Obviously, you had a family.
Yes.
How did it change, if at all, your relationship with your wife when you go from being partner, lover, and then in many ways she was a caregiver for a while?
Yes, for a very long time. I mean, I needed, when I was in the hospital for 5 months, and when I come home, it's kind of like being a little kid when things change. I had deformities to my hands. I was 100% blind back then. You know, there's no way I'm going to drive. I'm not the member of society that I used to be going back to work. So, yeah, she had to sacrifice her career at the time and be my caretaker on top of being a mom. And, you know, you see stories on the news all the time, and you just know that a year from now, that couple's not going to be together anymore. I mean, marriage is hard enough between a man and a woman, let alone throw in some life-changing adversity. But when you stand up and say your vows, the for better or worse, sometimes the or worse part will. And, you know, I give her a lot of credit for having the understanding that that's just the way it is. And, you know, today, if you were flying a wall in my house, you'd never know anything life-changing took place. It's just very normal routine, raise a kid, do what you're supposed to do. And I get, you know, I give her all the respect and credit in the world for understanding that. And she's she has her new career now. She's a school teacher, and she's paying it forward to all the young minds out there, and it's been beautiful.
Former Phoenix police officer Jason Schechterle. He and Landon J. Napoleon are the co-authors of the book Burning Shield. That's all for today's edition of KJZZ's Here and Now. Thanks to senior producer Sarah Ventry and Bruce Drummond for their help on today's program. Thank you very much for listening. If you missed any part of the program, please go online to kjzz.org later this afternoon. We hope you have a great rest of the day. I'm Steve Goldstein. This is listener-supported KJZZ-FM Phoenix and HD.